The brother of a woman accused of murdering her husband in Glacier Park takes the witness stand. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has an update on a new avalanche center. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a leader of the movement to get federal lands turned over to state control. The teenage brother of a Montana woman on trial in the death of her new husband broke down on the witness stand when asked to describe his feelings toward her. Michael Rutledge of Kalispell testified in tears today that he was angry with defendant Jordan Graham because she had lied about the disappearance of her husband, Cody Johnson, and kept adding more lies to cover it up. The 16-year-old Rutledge was with Graham when she led authorities to Johnson's body in Glacier National Park on July 11th. Rutledge says she told him to tell others that park rangers had found the body. Graham initially said Johnson disappeared July 7th after leaving with friends. She later told federal investigators she and Johnson argued and he accidentally fell from a cliff when she tried to remove his hand from her arm. Graham cried quietly during her brother's testimony.
And in other news from around the state, a University of Montana student has reported being sexually assaulted in her dorm room. Missoula Police Lieutenant Bob Boucher says the woman reported Sunday that she had been raped by an acquaintance. University of Montana legal counsel Lucy France says UM police called Missoula City Police. France says the facts did not warrant a campus-wide text message or email warning of an alleged assault.
Because there was not an ongoing danger to the campus community, an ongoing emergency, and if it would aid in the prevention of similar crimes, it was the facts as I understood them did not warrant a timely warning.
The Missoula Police Department continues its investigation.
A former Anaconda Deer Lodge County Commissioner who was convicted of two felony sex crimes against a child has been sentenced to 25 years in prison and must serve at least 10 before being eligible for parole. The Montana Standard reports 53-year-old Robert Pierce of Opportunity was sentenced today in district court in Anaconda. In April, a jury found Pierce guilty of sexual intercourse without consent and sexual assault. Prosecutors said the girl was molested between 2006 and 2008 and reported to authorities in 2012. Pierce has maintained his innocence. Pierce was sentenced today to 40 years in prison with 15 suspended for rape and a concurrent 25 years for sexual assault.
Two residents of the Rocky Boys Indian Reservation are charged in the death of a child. The U.S. Attorney's Office says 21-year-old Garrett Kirby LaFrambois and 22-year-old Cecilia Rose Gardepi of Box Elder pleaded not guilty Friday to second-degree murder and assault resulting in serious bodily injury. The indictment says the two were charged in the October 21st death of someone with the initials K.S. who was younger than 18. Federal officials declined to identify the victim. U.S. Magistrate Judge Keith Strong appointed public defenders for both defendants.
Officials in Lake County are investigating two weekend shootings at a trailer park in Pablo. Undersheriff Dan Yonkin tells KERR-AM that three people were arrested Sunday for a shooting that Yonkin believes took place in retaliation for a shooting a day earlier. No one was injured in either shooting. On Saturday night, someone fired five rounds from a shotgun into a trailer house with several people inside, including children. On Sunday, someone used a handgun to fire shots at another trailer. Yonkin says 19-year-old Jonathan Drennan Beck is facing charges of attempted deliberate homicide for the second shooting, along with drug possession, while 19-year-old Francis Burke and 18-year-old Victor Barnaby are charged with felony conspiracy and possessing drugs. Yonkin says Saturday night's shooter is still at large.
The one-year anniversary of the Newtown shooting that took the lives of 20 young students and six adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School will be observed in Missoula this Saturday with a vigil and a bell ringing. The event is co-sponsored by the Montana chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America and Mayors Against Illegal Guns. It's one of several events being held across the country to both honor those lost to gun violence and urge gun reform. Kim Russell is director of outreach for the National Moms Demand Action Group and herself a survivor of gun violence. In 1999, she was shot during a robbery in which a close friend of hers was also shot and killed. She says the Newtown shooting a year ago prompted her to become an activist for more gun regulation.
I thought as a mother, it is my right to protect my children. And that's what I have to do. And once you have that image, you know, that image played in my mind, an image of a gun being at my daughter's head instead of my head, because she was in first grade when Newtown happened. I couldn't shake that image for weeks. And I can't live with that, and I don't want to live with that. No parent should live with the fear of sending their children to public elementary school and not picking them up.
We will have a feature interview with Russell tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition. The Saturday Newtown Memorial, called No More Silence, begins at 10 a.m. at the Union Hall in Missoula with remarks from Mayor John Engen and others, followed by a communal bell ringing to honor the Newtown victims.
Prosecutors say a Billings man assaulted his three-month-old daughter, fracturing her skull and breaking her arms. The Billings Gazette reports 23-year-old Nicholas Lay Ulmer was charged yesterday in justice court with three counts of felony assault on a minor. His bail was set at $50,000, and he is to be arraigned on December 17th. Ulmer is not permitted to have contact with his daughter or the child's mother if he is able to post bond. Charging documents say the baby was taken to the hospital last Thursday. Her right arm was broken in two places. She had an older fracture in her left arm and an older skull fracture. Court records say Ulmer told officers the injuries happened when he yanked her out of a swing by her arm.
A security forces journeyman assigned to Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls has died after collapsing while lifting weights. 341st Missile Wing Commander Colonel Robert Stanley tells the Great Falls Tribune that Senior Airman Vincent Sanchez of Downey, California, died Sunday evening. He was working out at a missile alert facility when he collapsed. He was provided medical aid on scene, but died before being transported to a Lewistown hospital. Sanchez, who was 23, entered the Air Force in December 2009 and arrived at Malmstrom in July 2010. His death is under investigation. Stanley expressed the unit's condolences to Sanchez's family.
Northwestern Energy says the recent cold snap led to a record natural gas delivery last Friday. Utility spokesman Butch Larcom says Montana customers used 302 million cubic feet of natural gas on Friday, breaking the old mark of 298 million cubic feet set in 1972. That volume dropped a bit over the still cold weekend.
It was 301 million cubic feet on the next day, on Saturday, December 7th, and it dropped off a little bit on Sunday. So, yeah, it was still high compared to the normal levels, but it did drop off a little bit.
Larcom says a reduction in business use led to the decreased demand. Demand for electricity also was high, but did not break a record. Larcom says the peak load on Sunday reached 1,728 megawatts. The record of 1,805 megawatts was set in December 2008. With one notable exception, he says Northwestern's physical infrastructure handled the cold snap and subsequent demand quite well.
Well, we did fine on the natural gas side. On the electric side, we did have some outages. You know, we had a pretty significant outage on Saturday in Great Falls that left about 3,000 people without power. And we had a problem in a substation that we're attributing the problem to just the bitter cold. It was 33 or 34 below zero overnight in Great Falls that day. Well, we had most of the people back within 3 or 4 hours, but then there were some stragglers. There were some people that were out for 5 or 6 hours. So it made for a pretty cold Saturday morning.
Customers will, of course, notice last week's additional demand for gas and electricity in their bills. That can be especially nerve-wracking for people who are having a tough time making ends meet.
Budget billing is a good option, and then, you know, we also encourage people to consider some other strategies, like turning down their thermostats at night and checking the setting on their hot water heaters and things like that can also affect their bill. There are programs that are run outside of Northwestern Energy that provide energy assistance. You know, there's Energy Share of Montana, and there's a low-income energy assistance program, too, that are available. You know, if they call our call center, we can direct them to those people. Again, we don't run those programs, but, you know, certainly they're available to people to help with bills if they really need it.
And Northwestern Energy's Montana customer service number is 888-467-2669.
Democratic U.S. Senate candidate John Bollinger says he will also use his campaign to lead an effort to change the Montana Constitution. Bollinger says civil rights are threatened by warrantless invasions by the Federal National Security Agency. He said today he wants to expand constitutional restrictions on warrantless searches to cover digital communications. He says it would send a message to federal agencies. It takes nearly 50,000 signatures from registered voters to change the Constitution. Bollinger says he will lead the signature gathering effort as he runs against Lieutenant Governor John Walsh in the Democratic primary. Bollinger previously served as a Republican Lieutenant Governor and state senator.
The Avalanche Education, Training, and Information outlet in the Flathead has been in flux over the past few years, with old partnerships ending and new ones forming. The National Forest is hoping to build new partnerships and answer some of the demand for upgraded services through the Flathead Avalanche Center. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more with the center's new director.
Eric Peitsch works with the U.S. Geological Survey based in Glacier Park as a physical scientist.
Everything from climate change research to snow avalanche research and snow ecology and avalanche ecology research.
Peitsch has also been the avalanche forecaster during spring plowing on the Going to the Sun Road.
Basically, we get into the office around 4 or 4:30 in the morning, look at weather models, and look at the remote weather stations to determine, you know, what has happened overnight. If it's snowed, how much snow has fallen, what's the temperature, and that still applies, you know, here in this position as well during the winter.
Peitsch says they're then typically in the field, skis on by 7 or 8 in the morning. This routine for the springtime avalanche watching for the Park Service will be similar to what Peitsch and other Flathead Avalanche Center personnel are doing this winter. Peitsch is the new part-time interim director for the center.
This advisory applies only to backcountry areas outside established ski area boundaries.
This is a clip from the advisory from Sunday, December 8th. Something new this year is when those advisories are running. There are three like last year, but this year they're scheduled for Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday through the hotline or online at flatheadavalanche.org. Information about the snowpack is being compiled through observations from the Avalanche Center personnel and through observations from the public.
And we basically compile all of those observations and interpret them appropriately, and we then, you know, summarize them and try and put it into a very readable and understandable format. And then we provide a snowpack discussion, so we talk about our avalanche problems.
Those avalanche problems would include things like storm snow, what fresh snow means in the overall picture of the snowpack, and instabilities at the new old snow interface. The area being covered includes the Flathead, Swan, and Whitefish ranges within the Flathead National Forest and portions of Glacier National Park and Kootenai National Forest. Peitsch earned his bachelor's degree from Lewis and Clark College in Oregon in environmental studies. He's worked as a ski patroller at the Alpine Meadows ski area in Lake Tahoe, California, before earning his master's degree in snow science from Montana State University. Peitsch has been meeting with people across the backcountry recreation community.
You know, folks right now, they want to see, they want a lot of collaboration between the center and the community. And ultimately, if, you know, the community is providing support, then they certainly deserve, they deserve some sort of investment in the Avalanche Center.
Peitsch says that investment comes through in a quality product. He says they currently only have the resources for 3 forecasts per week, but ultimately would like to provide 7. He says his role is to bring the Flathead Avalanche Center up to standards consistent with other avalanche centers across the West.
As well as, you know, make sure that the community and the recreating public is getting a very high quality product in terms of advisories and education. So, you know, there's a lot of momentum right now. There's a lot of energy, and there are a lot of folks interested in potentially helping out the Avalanche Center in various ways.
In the past, there was a collaborative effort in the Flathead with the Glacier Country Avalanche Center Incorporated, which has since dissolved. Peitsch says a model that has been shown to work is collaboration between a friends group and the Forest Service, and gives the Utah Avalanche Center as an example.
They have Forest Service avalanche specialists working, you know, with friends groups to kind of achieve this goal of avalanche education and avalanche information dissemination through their area. And so it's a model that works, and there are a few folks right now that are interested in potentially making that work again here. And so, you know, we'll see what happens on that end.
Funding for this 20 to 30 hour per week position comes from the Forest Service and Recreational Trails Program grant through the U.S. Department of Transportation. The center provides avalanche training and education in addition to the forecasts. Peitsch says they will continue with a 3 times per week forecast. However, the weather doesn't operate on a schedule. He says if changing conditions warrant an update, they'll put one out. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
A Massachusetts-based airline is now providing essential air service flights in Montana. The Billings Gazette reports Cape Air began serving 5 Montana cities today, taking over the federally subsidized routes between Billings and Glendive, Glasgow, Sydney, Havre, and Wolf Point. Cape Air flights on its 9 passenger planes cost $49 each way, which includes all taxes and fees. The planes can carry 1,600 pounds of weight, so ticket agents have to ask passengers how much they weigh. Passengers could even end up sitting next to the pilot. Cape Air employs 50 people in Montana, including 20 in Billings.
Greek yogurt company Chobani says it is increasing production at its Twin Falls, Idaho plant and adding a production of a new light yogurt called Simply 100. Chobani officials tell the Times News the $450 million plant is running at optimal production capability for the first time since it opened a year ago. When the plant opened, it made about 100,000 cases of yogurt per week, running three or four production lines. It is now running 12 production lines and producing up to 1 million cases of yogurt a week. The plant's first year was not without difficulties. In September, Chobani recalled 35 varieties of yogurt that may have been contaminated with mold. Some containers bloated, and some consumers said the yogurt made them sick.
Last week, we aired an interview with UM forestry professor Martin Nye about the resurgence of a Western movement to get federal lands turned over to state and local governments and why he thinks that's a bad idea. In tonight's feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with one of the leaders of the new Sagebrush Rebellion, Utah State Representative and CEO of the American Lands Council, Ken Ivory, about why he thinks state ownership of federal lands is a good idea. Ivory authored the Utah Transfer of Public Lands Act, which calls for the federal government to hand over management of their land in Utah to that state by next year.
Mr. Ivory, explain to me what federal land ownership you're opposed to specifically.
Well, when you say what federal land ownership, you look back and the important question, Sally, is why does the federal government control more than 50% of the land in the western United States and less than 5% of the land in all the states east of Montana? It's really fascinating that the public land question started back in 1780 in the middle of the Revolutionary War and as a means of resolving the funding issues in the war, the state ceded land to the federal government. And the federal government promised, it wasn't even the federal government then, but through other acts, the federal government promised all states that it would dispose of, transfer title to its land, its statehood. And Montana's promise in their Enabling Act, and Utah and all the other western states, is word for word the same as the states east of Montana for them to dispose of the land, and they simply haven't. And so the question we're asking, and in time for a new conversation on the transfer of public land, is why the difference when there's more than $150 trillion in mineral value locked up in the federally controlled lands and the forest issues that you know so well there under federal management? Fires are raging out of control and killing millions of animals and devastating watershed for generations.
There are, as you know, many people who disagree with your legal interpretation of the state enabling acts. In terms of specifically what federal public land do you think should go to the states is my original question.
Well, in terms of what land, constitutionally, legally, they should transfer all the land. Now, in Utah, we've made the decision as a legislative body to exempt national parks, congressionally designated wilderness, and most national monuments, the only exclusion being the Escalante.
And why? Why exempt national parks, for example?
Well, we did that as a legislative decision. After 117 years, they've developed a character of their own. And as long as the federal government is able and willing to operate and maintain them as national parks, that as a legislative body, we've made the decision to keep that in that character.
But why would you think it's okay for the federal government to manage national parks but not manage, for example, national forests? I'm trying to get your distinction there.
Well, again, that was a decision made by the legislature. Which
is that one you agree with?
I don't know that I want to say reluctantly. Yes, for the present, yes. We've developed a character of national parks and a worldwide attention to national parks. Now, in the national forests, to the question that you asked, federal forest policies are devastating the forest. They're destroying habitat and watershed and wildlife through arbitrary federal policies that don't allow harvesting on almost any of the forest lands. I mean, I think one of the best analogies came from a county commissioner in Idaho, and he said, you know, if you think about having a pen that would hold 50 head of cattle, and instead of putting 50 head in there, you put 1,000, and you leave a 55-gallon drum of water and just walk away. Well, anyone that knows anything about those living organisms knows that they're going to get sick and they're going to die in those conditions. Well, in our forest conditions, we've got policies now that, you know, no fault of the forest managers on the ground, but the policies that go back to Washington and the litigation and the regulations and conditions end up with the result that we're not harvesting any of those trees. And you've got hundreds and up to thousands of trees to an acre, where in western forests, often the sustaining capacity of the forest is somewhere between 50 and 100 trees to an acre.
Is it fair to characterize, Mr. Ivory, your argument that you want the federal public land to be given to the states so that they can be more developed, that there can be, for example, timber and mining development that isn't going on now? Is that your primary reason?
Well, no, there's a lot of reasons. You look at better funding education, better caring for the environment, and growing local and national economies.
Would you, Mr. Ivory, if the state did own lands that are now owned by the federal government, would you want the state to preserve any of that land for uses that did not lean toward development?
Yeah, of course. In fact, we've already done that. In Utah, again, as a legislature, we took off the table the lands that are already designated as national parks and congressionally designated wilderness and all of the national monuments except one. And we're already looking at other state wilderness bills. And then beyond that, we look at multiple use with sustained yield and local planning, so that it's not an and-or proposition. You have areas that would be primarily energy development or resource development, timber development areas. You have a large variety of other areas that are recreation areas, but to have it be an either or simply disregards the realities on the ground. The fundamental question is, do we believe in the right to govern ourselves at the local level, or do we not?
In terms of governing at the local level versus not, it sounds like you don't think there should be any federal governing.
That's what our nation was founded upon in terms of land, right? The Constitution delegated very specific things to the federal government, coining the money and war and commerce with foreign nations and that sort of thing. But the notion of property and the local control of property And those were foundational principles upon which our nation was based. And so when you look at that governing principle, that was the whole underlying basis for why there was a revolution with Great Britain. The king was coming in and saying, oh, those forests are mine, and those trees are mine, and that land is mine. And they knew that without the right and control of property, which is the essence of liberty, which is the whole purpose of life, they needed to alter that question. And that was the very foundation of our nation. Well, now, when more than one-third of the total land mass in our nation is federally controlled, John Kenneth Galbraith, world-renowned economist, made a statement. He said, where socialized ownership of land is concerned, only the USSR and China can claim company with the United States of America.
The courts don't agree with you to this point, Mr. Ivory, and there are those who say that your effort is going to be an expensive losing battle.
That's a pretty bold statement. Where do the courts not agree with us, Sally?
Well, where have they appealed? The law passed by the Utah legislature has not gone into effect and is not likely to.
No, the law is in effect.
Well, not in terms of state ownership of federal lands. Currently.
Right, and so we've set a date to coordinate with our federal governing partner on the transfer of the land. There's certainly nothing unconstitutional with.
Do you think that's actually going to happen next year? That Utah is going to get the federal land that you now have in federal ownership?
Well, we're certainly working towards that, and the federal government can choose to do what it's going to do, and then the state of Utah, along with five other states that are moving in the similar direction, will decide what we're going to do. But this blanket statement that somehow it's unconstitutional or the courts are opposed, I would encourage you to go actually look at the issues. The Federalist Society is an organization of 40,000 constitutionally focused lawyers, scholars, and professors. They've done a full legal analysis of what we've done, and they conclude that it's legally, historically, and constitutionally based, that the federal government has a duty to dispose of the land, and that Congress does not have the right or the authority to unilaterally change the vested rights of our statehood, particularly where public lands are at stake. But there's a lot of work to do, Sally. So what we're doing now in Utah is a lot of the logistics and analysis, the economic analysis, the logistical analysis of working to transition out of 100 years where the federal government has not kept the same promise with our states that it kept with all states east of Montana.
I have been speaking with Utah Representative Ken Ivory, who's also the CEO of the American Lands Council. Mr. Ivory, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Shelley.
Ken Ivory will give a public lecture tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Eagles Lodge in Hamilton.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with isolated snow and patchy freezing fog with lows 6 to 13 degrees. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs in the mid-20s to lower 30s. For central Montana, there is a high wind watch in effect from Wednesday evening through Thursday evening for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of snow in the evening with lows 5 below to 10 above zero. Gusts of wind could be up to 45 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with highs 25 to 35 degrees, with west winds 20 to 25 miles per hour in the afternoon and gusts up to 40 miles per hour. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies in the evening, then becoming partly cloudy with a slight chance of snow in the evening and lows 5 below to 5 above zero. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 20 to 25 degrees.
Currently in our listening area, Helena is 23 degrees with cloudy conditions. In Kalispell, it's cloudy and 20 degrees. Butte has 20 degrees under cloudy skies as well. Great Falls is cloudy with 11 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under cloudy skies is 23 degrees. It's 15 degrees and clear in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's cloudy and 26 degrees. Libby has 21 with partly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are cloudy and it's 22 degrees.
If you have a comment on tonight's broadcast, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on our Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.